The instructor in the college class prepared a lecture on the law of the pendulum. He spent 20 minutes teaching the physical principles that govern a swinging pendulum. And the law of the pendulum is, a pendulum can never return to a point higher than the point from which it was released because of the friction and gravity. When the pendulum returns, it always falls short of that mark. Each time it swings, it makes less and less of an arc until finally it comes to rest. The point of rest is called a state of equilibrium, when all the forces on the pendulum are equal. And to illustrate the point, this college professor attached a 3-foot string to a child's toy top, and he secured it to the top of the blackboard with a thumbtack. And he pulled the top back to one side and made a mark on the blackboard where he released the pendulum. And each time it swung back, he made a new mark. And it took less for a minute for the top to come to complete rest. And when he finished this demonstration, the markings on the blackboard, each one was less than the one before it, proved the law of the pendulum. Then he asked how many people in the class believed the law of the pendulum. And all the students in the class raised their hands. Then he asked them again, did they really believe in the law of the pendulum, if that was really true? And again, he got complete agreement. Again, the college professor chose out one particular a student who was real enthused and real adamant about it. And he asked him to take part in an experiment to prove that he really, really believed. And he asked the students to go to the gym, and hanging right in the middle of the gym floor from the beam way up high at the top of the gym was a rope, and suspended from this rope was 250 pounds of weights on this rope. It was a very large, crude, fundamental, but it was a functional pendulum. And they had this 250 pounds tied to the pendulum. And this rope, as I said, went all the way to the top of the gym. And this student was asked to climb up on a table at the edge, at the end of the gym, at the edge of the gym floor, and sit in a chair with his back against the cement wall. Then this professor went the opposite end of the gym, or no, he went to the same end of the gym, and brought this 250 pounds of metal, which was suspended from this rope, and he brought it right up to the student's nose where he was facing this thing. Once again, he explained the law of the pendulum. The student had only applauded just a few minutes before, saying he was in complete agreement. So he said, if the law of the pendulum is true, when I release this mass of metal, it will swing across the gym floor and return short of the release point. Your nose will be in no danger. And after he finally restated this law, he looked the student in the eye and asked, sir, do you believe this law is true? And there was a long pause. Huge beads of sweat came out on this student's forehead. And weakly he said, yes, I believe it. The professor went to the opposite, or went and released the pendulum from his nose, from this student's nose. And it made a swishing noise that arced across the gym floor, went all the way to the other end of the gym. The class had never seen this student move so fast. He literally dived off the table. And the question could be asked, did this student really believe the law of the pendulum? When he was put to the test, did he really believe? You know, like the Apostle Peter, in his human reasoning, he felt that he could stand strong. But when he was put to the test, his faith wavered. It wasn't until he was plugged into the real source of power that he was able to obtain real faith from God's Spirit. You know, Christ calls each of us personally, saying he will guide us through our life and all its dangers. And you know, as we approach the end of this age, the Bible predicts that faith will become more and more of a rare commodity. And the question was asked, will there be any faith on earth in the last generation before Jesus Christ returns? And Jesus himself questioned whether there would be or not. In the book of Luke, Christ asked this question. Let's look at Luke chapter 18. Luke chapter 18. In Luke chapter 18, verse 8, nevertheless, Jesus asked, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth? You know, that is a very sobering question. In Matthew 24, Christ was asked by his disciples when the kingdom would actually come. And you know, Christ went on to give several signs of the approaching kingdom, what would be taking place in this world before he returned again. In verse 36, he said, but of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven and my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man be. And he mentions world in Noah's age at the end of that age. And we know that faith was not a very common commodity even in the days of Noah. I read this little story about Noah. It's entitled, Faith Doesn't Have Excuses. And this author wrote, said, and the Lord said to Noah, where is the ark which I have commanded you to build? You know, it's not finished yet. And Noah said to the Lord, verily I have had three carpenters off ill. The gopher wood supplier has let me down. Yes, even the gopher wood has been on order for 9 to 12 months. What can I do, Lord? And God said to Noah, according to the plan, this ark needs to be finished within the month. And Noah said, it will be so. But later Noah returned to the Lord. And the Lord said, Noah, what seems to be the trouble this time? And Noah said to the Lord, my subcontractor has gone bankrupt. The pitch which you commanded me to put on the outside and the inside of the ark has not arrived. The plumber is going on strike. Shem, my son, who helps me on the ark side of the business, he's formed a pop group with his brothers Ham and Japheth. Lord, I'm completely undone. And the Lord said, well, what about the animals? The male and female animals of every sort I've ordered, you know, they're supposed to be on the face of the earth. And Noah said they were delivered to the wrong address, but they should arrive on Friday. The Lord said, how about the unicorns and the fowl of the air by sevens? And Noah wrung his hand and wept, saying, Lord, unicorns are a discontinued line. You cannot get them for love nor money. And the fowls of the air are not sold in sevens, they're sold in half dozens. Lord, you know how it is. And the Lord in his wisdom said, Noah, my son, I know. Why else do you think I'm going to send a flood? You know, in seriousness, when we look at Noah, faith indeed was a rare commodity at that point. You know, in his time, God had warned about the impending destruction that was about to come upon the earth. But look how many actually believed and acted on that belief. You know, brethren, there were just 8 people on that ark. We don't know how many people were on the earth at that time, but it's estimated to be in maybe up to even to 1 billion people. But when the rain came and the door of the ark had been shut, the multitudes, the majority, was on the outside. And you know, when that rain came and the water started rising, there was probably much regret at that point. There was probably much crying and gnashing of teeth. Let's look at Matthew 25. You know, can you imagine the regret at that door was shut? And they found that they could not get on that ark. You know, they literally missed the boat. In Matthew 25, we read a similar experience that's going to take place at the end time. Matthew 25, verse 10. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom, speaking of Christ, came. And those who were ready went in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. Just like in the days of Noah, the ark door was shut. Afterwards, the other virgins came also, saying, Lord, open to us. But he answered and said, Assuredly, I say to you, I do not know you. Again, missing the boat. You know, God clearly states that his people, the just, must live by faith, and that without faith it is impossible to please God. But on the other hand, dynamic living faith is a rare commodity in this dying world. And we know that faith is one of the fruits of God's Spirit. So today I'd like to look at the question of Christ concerning faith. Will he find faith on the earth when he returns? You know, as we approach the end of this age, we need to see how we can acquire this commodity, this increasingly rare commodity, to acquire the type of faith that Jesus Christ is talking about. At first, we must realize that we must have faith in. The faith is not in physical laws, like the law of the pendulum. It is not in men. Faith is not in the physical realm. But faith is in the spiritual. It is of God. And we must believe what God says and trust God. You know, what do the scriptures actually say? We've all read that Abraham believed God and it was counted to him for righteousness. It's no wonder that the real living faith is a dying commodity. For brethren, we live in a world that's bent on discrediting God, discrediting his word by any means possible. You know, things have really been turned upside down. It may seem that a lot of people will believe anything that men say or write, but when it comes to God, you know, what God says or what God has written in his word, it's a very different story. And I've always been amazed about what people really will believe. I remember this one supermarket tabloid, and the following headlines were observed on this tabloid. It said, Dinosaurs once honked like Buicks. Cow mattresses help cows produce more milk. Adam and Eve's bones found in Asia. Eve was a space alien. World War II bomber found on the moon. A mom-to-be on diet of only chicken lays huge egg. Woman gives birth to a 2-year-old baby. The child walks and talks in 3 days. You know, people will read and believe this kind of nonsense, but they refuse the evidence concerning God, Jesus Christ. And this is, brethren, this is really a major problem in this materialistic generation, so steeped in evolution. It can be extremely difficult if you go through the educational system to really believe in God. You know, all true Christians have an earnest desire to live by faith. But, you know, there's been such an explosion of this materialistic knowledge on every imaginable subject, medicine, psychology, sociology, biology, astronomy, history, geology, that we can automatically find ourselves asking the question to almost every statement or promise God makes in the Bible. And when we get around to it, these are faith-killing questions. You know, think about it. Why does God allow good people to suffer and die while evil people often live well, they live well and prosper? And people ask the question, how could the earth, including Mount Everest and all the high mountains on this earth, have ever been completely covered with water during the flood in Noah's day? Not even 5,000 years ago. You know, where did all that water come from and where did it go? Where did a fish large enough to swallow Jonah come from? And how did Jonah breathe for 3 days and 3 nights while he's in the whale's belly? And so the questions go on and on. And these are all questions in an attempt to discredit God, trying to make God out as unbelievable, trying to kill faith in God. And it seems it is the more prevalent in the education, it seems to be more prevalent in the education system than anywhere else. And the scriptures say in Hebrews, by faith, they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. You know, God's miracles are not in the physical realm. There's no, it can, doesn't have to be a physical explanation for all these things. Because that's what a miracle is. It's something in the spiritual realm. And a school teacher was doing her best to discredit the miracles of the Bible. And she said, take for instance the crossing of the Red Sea. We know that, I've heard this too, that that body of water was only 6 inches deep where they crossed the Red Sea. Immediately, she made that statement. Immediately, someone in the back said, well, thank God for that miracle. And the teacher was annoyed by the mentioning the word miracle. She said, what miracle? Well, the boy said it had to be a miracle to drown the whole Egyptian army in 6 inches of water. You know, these miracles are not our ways or reasons. Let's examine some examples of the eroding effect that human reasoning can have upon faith. You know, God knows that we at this time, while we're still physical, that spiritually we can only see through a glass dimly, that we simply do not completely understand why things are allowed to happen as they do. But we still must learn to believe and trust God. And He knows that we cannot completely understand how things are accomplished by His Holy Spirit. Brethren, we are not spirit. We can't understand completely spiritual matters. It's similar to the way that scientists explain the mystery of the black holes in the universe. And actually, these black holes, they say, are stars which have actually collapsed. They're huge stars, and the gravitational pull on these masses of on this massive star is so great that the light cannot even come out from these stars. The gravitational pull is so strong. They do not emit any light, but nevertheless are powerful forces, even though they're not visible. And this scientist likened it to a dance floor with the ladies in white dresses and the men in black suits. And if the lights were all turned down, all that could be seen is the white dresses of these ladies dancing. And yet we know there were men there because of the pattern of the ladies' movement. They are the unseen partners leading them. And you know, life's problems are much like this. You know, in the dark times of life, the lights have been turned down, and we can only see part of what is actually taking place. Yet faith in God believes His unseen hand is still controlling those events. Only the lights will be turned up one day, and we will be able to understand. And the closer we get to the spiritual mind, the better we will understand spiritual matters, the more clearly we will be able to see. You know, if we could see clearly, it wouldn't be faith anymore that we had. We would be walking by sight, not faith. You know, John the Baptist's imprisonment and his reaction to it is a good example of having to trust and believe completely, but not understanding why. Even John the Baptist at that point in his life became confused and upset. And his reactions during this severe trial that he was going through are quite similar to the attitudes and reactions of many of us undergoing trials today. You know, John knew who Christ was. John twice called Him the Lamb of God. Yet, while John was in prison, John's mind began to focus on the physical. And John sent two of his disciples to Jesus Christ with this question. And he asked Him, "Are you the coming one, or do we look for another?" But John full well knew who Christ was, and that Christ had the power to free him from that prison. What John perhaps was wondering was why Christ had not freed him from prison, why he was in this predicament. And John's basic question, a faith-killing question, may have been why. And Christ pointed out to John's disciples the works that He had been doing, works which He knew John was well aware of. Then He concluded with this statement to John's disciples, "And blessed is he who is not offended because of me." You know, Jesus was telling John, He's telling all of us, that God's people may not understand everything at a certain time, And oftentimes it's difficult, it's very difficult to understand the end result, the purpose of what's going on. But at that point, we should not reject God and Christ. We shouldn't lose faith because of it. You know, John not only remained in prison, but John was beheaded. You know, why did Christ allow John to die? Probably there's not one person in this room who knows the complete answer to that question. But we have to accept it on faith that fit God's purpose at that time. Another potential problem that can undermine godly faith is the suffering of trials. You know, take the example of Job. Job chapter 36. We find here in chapter 36 that Job, like John, was sorely afflicted and tried. And Job, he too wondered why. He wanted to know the why. And it was a young Elihu who gave Job some answers. And these same answers were available to John the Baptist, and they're available to us today. The problem is often, brethren, they're the answers that we don't want to hear. Job 36, verse 21. Job chapter 36, verse 21. Elihu told Job, "Take heed, do not turn to iniquity, for you have chosen this rather than affliction. Behold, God is exalted by his power. Who teaches him? Indeed, who else but God can teach through affliction?" And you know, brethren, sometimes these lessons are severe. But sometimes, as human beings, that is the way we have to learn. Unfortunately, that is the way we have to learn certain lessons. Job 33, verse 14. Job 33, 14. "For God may speak in one way or in another, yet man does not perceive it. In a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls upon men, while slumbering on their beds, when he opens the ears of men and seals their instruction. In order to turn man from his deeds and conceal pride from man, he keeps back his soul from the pit and his life from perishing by the sword. Man is also chastened with pain on his bed, and with strong pain in many of his bones, so that his life abhors bread and his soul succulent food. His flesh wastes away from sight, and his bones stick out, which were once not seen. Yet his soul draws near the pit and his life to the executioners." Very severe trials he's talking about. And God uses all these methods to work with humanity, to bring us to his own state of perfection, to literal sonship and daughtership in his family. Verse 39, "Behold, God works all these things twice, in fact, three times with a man, to bring his soul from the pit, that he may be enlightened with the light of life." You know, God says he allows these trials so that we may be enlightened with the light of life, eternal life. And brethren, too often, sometimes we lose sight of that awesome goal. But you know, God never does lose sight. Losing sight of the goal causes us to lose faith. And undergoing severe trials and losing sight of our goal can erode our faith. Another thing that can erode our faith is the society that we live in today. You know, it's prophesied to get much worse as we near the end of this age. You know, because that we live in a very evil world, and often we have to suffer with this world's society. And Jesus, speaking to the Father, said, "I do not pray that you should take them out of this world, but you should keep them from the evil one." So when some tragedy strikes because of someone else's fault in society, we must not blame God. Many of our problems occur actually because we are living in a very evil society. And often seems that people, if they think of God at all, blame him for every calamity and tragedy of life. And seldom do we thank him or praise him for all the good things that he does. That's human reasoning. It's funny, those who write insurance policies often refer to natural disasters such as floods, earthquakes, and tornadoes as acts of God. You know, that is oftentimes humanity's view of God. But this is how we should think of our Creator, for James wrote, "Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning." In other words, we can depend on God. We can have that faith in God. And faith is often undermined by our wondering, why, God, did you allow this to happen to me? And John the Baptist probably went to his execution wondering, why? Why was this happening? But you know, John must have heeded Jesus Christ's instruction not to be offended, because Christ said of him, "Among those born of women, there is no greater prophet than John the Baptist." You know, Jesus was saddened when he heard about John's execution, and he wanted to go off by himself into the desert, but the multitudes followed him out there into the desert. And there Jesus displayed God's power by turning 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish and enough food for 5,000 men plus women and children. And after everyone was fed, 12 baskets of crumbs were left over. And you know, Christ's disciples were really impressed with his miracle-working power. But they too had to learn more regarding true faith. You know, consider a major pitfall in exercising faith is demanding to know how faith works, trying to put some kind of physical label on miracles and working faith. For example, you think about the miracle of healing. Is there a physical explanation for that? You know, in the preservation of the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, I mean, it'd be hard to come up with some physical explanation for that. And the feeding of the 5,000, there's no physical explanation of that faith. You know, asking how such miracles are accomplished is spiritual. And they're spiritual because they're miracles. They belong in the spiritual dimension and cannot be understood in physical terms. You know, how God accomplishes his purpose becomes so important to some people that they find when they cannot understand, they simply stop believing God or the biblical account. You know, you look at the example of evolution. It's humanity's attempt to explain in physical terms strictly something that took place that was spiritual. You know, some people think that they found out how life in the physical world evolved, and they no longer have to deal with the responsibility to God and that responsibility to him. Conditioning your faith, knowing how God's purpose are accomplished, can destroy your faith. And that was a major lesson that Christ's apostles had to learn. In Matthew chapter 14, this is an example where Peter found himself in a situation that the how of a great miracle so plagued him and his physical senses that his faith actually vanished. I'm sure we all remember the incident of Peter walking on the water. Matthew chapter 14, verse 22. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. You know, this was just after the miracle of feeding the multitudes, and it was still very early in the evening, but said in the scriptures here, a storm came up and so tossed the boat about that the apostles could make little headway. Notice, as fierce as this storm was, the disciples gave no indication of panic as long as they were in the security of this boat. Verse 25, and when they had spent most of the night fighting the heavy seas, Jesus appeared to them in the fourth watch. And naturally, it would be kind of troubling to them at the sight of Jesus walking on the water. That is, until Jesus talked to them, verse 27. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid." And the apostles were frightened at this unnatural sight of Jesus actually walking on the surface of the water. For, you know, this was contrary to any experience they'd ever had. However, when Jesus spoke to them, they were reassured and comforted. Think about why would that be? The unnatural situation of Jesus walking on the surface of the water was still there before their eyes. But they were giving a physical assurance that fed in with their past experience, the familiar voice of Jesus. Although they could not understand at this point how he managed to walk on the water, they were comforted to hear his familiar voice. And they were quite aware that Jesus Christ's story performed some great miracles. The disciples were growing in faith. They were beginning to believe the things that Jesus said. And we find that Peter here was so confident that he thought he could walk on the water also, if Jesus would actually tell him to do so. In verse 28, "And Peter answered him and said, 'Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water.'" You know, Peter knew that this feat was only possible if Christ actually commanded him to do so. And this is an important point in growing faith. For we, you know, we're told in 1 John, "Now this is the confidence that we have in him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us." Peter here was asking if this was Christ's will. And on that assurance, he had the confidence to step out of that boat onto the water. In verse 29, "So he said, 'Come.' And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus." Peter actually walked on the water. Now something totally alien to any experience Peter had ever had. And Peter's faith departed. You know, what was it? Verse 30. "When he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, 'Lord, save me.'" You know, had Peter been aware of the wind before that? You know, he certainly had. He and the other apostles spent, you know, the whole night being tossed about by the wind and the waves. But they had been in the relative security of the boat. So what happened that terrified Peter so much? It was not merely a matter of what didn't happen and what did. Peter was totally unprepared for how he was held up by faith. You know, where was faith supposed to act on Peter's body? To give him that reassuring sensation of physical support? Was it on the soles of his feet where he felt support when he walked on the solid surface? It wasn't there, no feeling of support at all. Was it the feeling of support under his arms? As one who would, you know, feel support by being held up under their arms, like a harness or something? No. Was it the feeling of support through his hair? Was he being held up by his hair? No. Peter nowhere could feel the sensation of physical support. You know, it was faith, a spiritual thing that was supporting him. Faith is spiritual, not physical. And Peter's mind, from long experience in the physical environment, knew of no reason why he should be standing on the surface of that water. Peter was unprepared for how faith could hold him up on the water. And he reacted to his physical senses at that point, and he began to sink. The lesson: one has to grow and exercise faith. Peter's faith in the person of Christ was still firm. In verse 31, "And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said, 'O you of little faith, why did you doubt?'" You know, in the firm grip of Christ's hand, Peter made it back to the boat. You know, there was simply no way at that point that Christ could have explained to Peter in terms that Peter could understand how faith could support him. Peter just had to experience it and grow in faith. And I read this story about this farmer who wanted to impress his hunting buddies. And to impress him, he brought the smartest, most expensive hunting dog that he could find. And he trained this dog to do something no other dog on earth could do. Impossible feats that surely would amaze anyone. And he invited his neighbors to go duck hunting with him. And after a long, patient wait in the boat, a group of ducks flew over. And the hunters were able to make a few hits. And several of these ducks fell into the water. "Go get them," shouted the proud owner of this magnificent dog. The dog leaped out of the boat. He walked on the water, picked up a bird, and returned to the boat. And as soon as he dropped that bird in the boat, or that duck in the boat, he trotted off across the water again. He grabbed another duck and brought it back to the boat. And the owner literally beamed with pride at this wonderful dog who could walk across the water. And he retrieved each of these ducks one by one. And unable to resist the opportunity to brag a bit to his fellow hunters, the guy said, did y'all notice anything unusual about my dog? And one of them rubbed his chin and thought for a while. Yes, he finally said, "Come to think of it, that silly dog doesn't know how to swim, does he?" You know, when you think about it, many gave Peter the same answer, the same reaction. Instead of recognizing that he is the only disciple to have the faith to step out of that boat, he's criticized for his lack of faith. You know, he draws close to Christ while 11 other disciples sit in the boat, content in their perceived safety. But Peter at that point had begun the process of growing in faith. By practicing faith, by doing something, he was the only one of the disciples who left the boat. And he began developing a living faith, you know, a trust in God. So we see that the living faith that Christ was talking about being so rare at the end time, it's believing what God says and trusting him. In Hebrews 11, let's look at a biblical definition of faith that we are all probably familiar with. In Hebrews 11, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. A man was walking along the edge of a cliff, and he slips off of the edge. And just as he is ready to plunge into the valley below, he grabs a branch on this shrub sticking out of the edge of the cliff, and he hangs on for dear life. And in desperation at that moment, he looks up and prays to God in heaven, saying, "God, please help me." In a flash, he hears a voice, "I'll help you, my child. Just trust and let go." But he holds on to that branch tighter and tighter. Now that branch begins to start to give away. And again he cries out, "God, help me." And again the voice, "I'll help you, child. Just please let go. Just trust me, let go." Again the struggle. Again the branch giving away even more. Again the cry, "God, help me." Again the voice, "I'll help you, my child. Just let go." And finally, in desperation, the man looks up to heaven again and shouts, "Is there anybody else up there?" You know, that is like our human nature. We want the answer we want to hear, our way, not God's. But now the rest of the story. The end of this story explains what faith really is. That's the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. This man did not want to let go of this branch, this very frail branch as it was, and trust God. And when this man finally looked down to the ground, his feet were dangling about 18 inches off the ground. Now he relaxed and let go of the branch. But brethren, at that point, he was not operating on faith. He was operating on sight. Had he let go of that branch before he looked down, he would have been exercising faith. How then can one have faith? How exactly does God give us faith? Ephesians 2. The truth is, the kind of faith that we need to have, that we desire, cannot be worked up like in a Pentecostal service. We just cannot work up this kind of faith. Ephesians 2, verse 8. It's not within us. Ephesians 2, verse 8. For by grace are you saved through faith, and that is not of yourselves. Faith, brethren, is the gift of God. God gives us the kind of faith that really works, the kind of faith required for salvation. And certainly we must want to have this faith. Who wouldn't want to have this type of faith? Required to receive God's wonderful blessings of protection, peace of mind, healing, all these other examples. So faith is a gift of God, is a fruit of God's Spirit. And we get this gift by letting the mind of God, Jesus Christ, dwell within us. It's not physical. It's not something physical, but spiritual. And the only way we can get it is contact with God. And we have to realize that it is a growing process. Luke 16. Luke 16. It's like so many things. When God deals with us, it has to start out small to be effective. The living faith in God starts out small like the mustard seed. Luke 16, verse 10. He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. The sign in the window read, "Boy Wanted." And young Jack John Simmons, though he was lazy, saw this opportunity and applied for the job. And he was quickly hired by the proprietor of the store. The pace was leisurely, so he enjoyed the job. But toward the middle of the afternoon, he was sent up into the attic. And the attic was a dingy place full of cobwebs infested with mice. And he was told he'd find a long, deep box up there. And he told him to sort out the contents of that box and sort out what should be saved and what shouldn't be saved. When John got up there, he was very disappointed. It was a large container, and there seemed to be nothing in it but old junk. And after a few minutes, he returned back down to the main floor of the store, and he's asked by the proprietor if he'd complete his work. "No, sir, it was cold and dark up there, and I didn't think it was worth doing." At closing time, he was paid and told not to return. The next morning, the old sign, "Boy Wanted," appeared in the usual place. And Crawford Hill was the next person to be employed, and he was asked to tidy up the same old box. However, he spent hours separating the usable nails and screws from the other things to be discarded. And suddenly he raced down the stairs all excited. "At the very bottom, I found this," he said, holding up a $20 bill. At last, the store felt he had discovered a conscientious boy to whom he could entrust his business when he retired. And years later, the proprietor of the store said, "This young man, who is now my successor, found his fortune in a junk box." Then, correcting himself, he said, "No, he actually found it in his mother's Bible, because he heeded the verse he was made to memorize. He that is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much." So we can see that faith is a growth process. You know, it seems like that the growth processes of God always have to start out small. And since faith is a gift, we have to go to God to get this gift. And we need to go in the presence of God to get this gift. We must have contact with God to get this gift. Isaiah 40. You know, as we maintain this contact through prayer and fasting and study, we get to know God. And actually, we start developing the very mind of God, begin to think as He thinks, which includes this gift of faith. Our faith will be in God. Because we'll begin, by studying His Word, we'll begin to understand His will. And by knowing God, it increases our faith. Isaiah 40, verse 11. He will feed His flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs with His arms and carry them in His bosom and gently lead those who are with young. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of His hand, measured heaven with a span, and calculated the dust of the earth in a measure, weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance. Brethren, our God is a miracle-performing God. He can handle these situations. Years ago, a military officer and his wife were aboard a ship that was caught in a raging ocean storm. And seeing the frantic look in her eyes, the man tried unsuccessfully to calm her fears. Suddenly, she grasped his sleeve and said, "How can you stand there in this terrible storm and be so calm?" And he stepped back a few feet and drew out his sword. And he pointed at her heart and said, "Are you afraid of this?" And without hesitation, she answered, "Of course not." "Why not?" he asked. "Because it's in your hand and you love me too much to hurt me." And to this he replied, "I know the one who holds the wind and the waters in the hollow of His hand, and He will surely care for us." You know, the officer was not disturbed because he had put his trust, his faith in God. And Romans 10 tells us how we can receive this true godly faith. Romans 10, verse 17. Very simple words here, but often going unheeded. Romans 10, verse 17. So faith comes from what is heard, and what is heard by the preaching of Christ. You know, faith comes from God's Word, by studying the Word of God. And when we study God's Word, with that contact, we can begin to see how God has fulfilled His promises in the past, how He's fulfilled His promises in His Word. And we can see what He prophesied for the past begins to come true. And by knowing this, our faith will increase. And knowing what He's prophesied of the future will also come true. In Revelation chapter 17, you know, it's not knowing the ending of a story before we read the whole book. I always remember Mr. Armstrong saying that he had read the end of the book, and we win. Revelation 17:14. Revelation 17:14. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for He is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those who are with Him are called chosen, faithful. We do win. When we have faith that God is working for our own good, we can relax. Let's look at Romans 8. Romans 8. We know there is amazing peace even when we don't even know the outcome. And growing in faith can give us that peace of mind. Romans 8, verse 28. Romans 8, verse 28. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. You know, by growing in faith, we can take on the trials, the adversity. The trials in our lives can be very, very tiring, very ugly. And with faith, we can transform them into something beautiful. You know, it's that way in nature, by taking something very unattractive and converting it into something of beauty. You know, by its chemical magic, a tree or plant can take the dark soil and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and combine those things. And with the aid of the sun, produce green leaves, colored flowers, vegetables, red roses, yellow tulips. And by means of a chemical process, we can take black coal and convert that substance into red dyes, synthetic rubber, nylon cloth. And faith can give, in the spiritual sense, can give life a similar transforming power. The power to take trouble, adversity, trials, and make it into something lovely and inspiring. And faith not only has that transforming quality, but faith is also not static. It's living, moving. It's a moving faith. And God's faith is not static. It's a living faith that involves action, oftentimes action on our part, and also action on the part of God. You know, it's a partnership. You know, sometimes it involves the risk, as Peter did in walking on the water, taking the risk and stepping out. And it's often been said that a ship can remain safe in the harbor. But brethren, a ship is meant to go out to sea and serve a purpose. And by staying in the harbor, the ships can remain safe, but they serve no purpose. James chapter 2, verse 14. James chapter 2, verse 14. James 2:14. What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? Verse 18. But someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. You believe there is one God, you do well. Even the demons believe and tremble. But do you know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead? You know, faith in Christ is more than an intellectual asset, just like the story I told you about the pendulum. It is believing with the heart, the will, with adoration, and with action. Years ago, a party of visitors at the National Mint were told by workmen at the smelting works that if you first dipped your hand in a bucket of water, a ladle of molten metal might be poured over the palm of your hand without burning it. And a husband and wife were part of those visitors. And perhaps you'd like to try it, the workman said to the husband. And the husband drew back rather sharply and said, no thanks, I'll take your word for that. And the workman turned to the wife. Perhaps you'd like to try it. And she said, yeah. And she pulled up the sleeve of her blouse and thrust her hand into the bucket of water. Calmly she held out her hand and the metal was poured into it. And we might ask, which of the two really believed the workman? You know, the husband believed at one level, but he wasn't willing to put his belief to the test. The wife, on the other hand, was willing to take the kind of risk, faith, as Christ demands. You know, as Christians, we're not to take a risk, as this woman did, depending on the physical. But we are to step out in the spiritual realm with our faith in God. And this brings us to the old controversy of faith versus works. You know, so many have had this misconception about faith and works that it's an either-or situation. You know, there is no conflict. There's no conflict between faith and works. In the Christian life, they go together like inhaling and exhaling. Faith is taking the gospel in. Works is taking the gospel out. Actually, what James is saying, you can't have one without the other. And the book of James balances off the matter of faith and works and reminds us that Christians, we must have both. True, we're not saved by works, but James reminds us we're not saved if good works do not follow. And some people actually argue this point so much, and I've heard it, and it almost becomes like an old argument, which comes first, the chicken or the egg. You know, the word believe comes from two words, be and live. Faith helps us to be spiritually, but afterwards, through works, we receive life. You know, it's a defined expression in Christian works and deeds to show that there's no conflict in the Scriptures between the two. You know, sometimes faith requires us to follow a road or a path that doesn't make much sense to the physical mind. For example, when the Israelites were leaving Egypt, you know, at that time, we all know there was a major highway that led north out of Egypt directly to the Promised Land. But God, instead of leading them north to the Promised Land by the shortest possible routes, like the interstate highway of that day, took them due south in the opposite direction. And we read in Hebrews 11 about the heroes of faith walking roads that weren't mapped out. Hebrews 11, verse 8. Hebrews 11, 8. Hebrews 11, verse 8. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. Verse 13. These all died in faith, not receiving the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had an opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. You know, it's not uncommon for maybe many of you to witness in late summer the migration of the monarch butterfly. And a careful observer may see many hundreds of these clinging to tree limbs and other shrubbery as the flock rests up for the journey to a remote mountain area in Mexico, in central Mexico. And scientists have found there are 16 of these sites ranging from 1 to 10 acres each. Within a 100-mile radius where millions upon millions of these butterflies from North America spend the winter. And after flying for thousands of miles, no one knows how they do this. Because, you know, we can take our maps and GPSs and still get lost. But these butterflies find their way to these tiny plots of land. And each new generation that migrates there has never been there before. They've never made that journey before. And something programmed in their tiny bodies directs them to the place they've never seen, but which they somehow, with their tiny little brains, they find. And you know, these butterflies are another example of God's creatures being drawn by the mind of their Creator. And they're also illustrated of the children of God, as referred in Hebrews 11. You know, the heroes of faith walked roads they had not mapped out. And they were following an inner leading to a land they'd never seen, a land prepared to them for them by their God. You know, after we've done our part in the walk of faith, we need to realize that living faith is a partnership. You know, after we've done all that we can, we have to step back at that point and let God do his part. You know, God showed the Israelites this. Let's look at what I was talking about earlier in Exodus 14. In Exodus 14, when he was leading them out of Egypt, you know, he led them to a point in the road where we find they had the mountains on their right, the mountain range came down in front of them, and the sea was on their left. And behind them, Pharaoh was in hot pursuit after them. And, you know, they had reached a point in their walk where there was nothing else that they could do. In Exodus 14, verse 12. Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us learn that we may serve the Egyptians? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness. Notice verse 13. And Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians who you see today, you shall see no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. You know, Larson, there's a man by the name of Larson Gwynn. He told the following story, happened a few years ago. And he almost drowned in a storm at sea in the Gulf of Mexico. He found himself swimming far from shore, and he's trying to reach, his boat had drifted off, and he's trying to reach his drifting boat. And he told how he got in this predicament through his own stupidity. Knowing that he wasn't going to make it, he remembers saying, well, this is it. The waves were maybe 6 or 7 feet tall, high, and the sky was dark with the wind and lightning, and he was drifting out to sea. But at the same time, he was praying to God, and he thought he heard a voice say, I'm here, can you tread water? Somehow, this had never occurred to him. He realized if he'd continued his frantic effort to swim back to shore, he would have exhausted his strength and gone down. You know, in all types of situations, we can make matters worse by our own frantic efforts to save ourselves. Maybe God is trying to tell us, stand still. You know, we have gotten ourselves into some hopeless situation, and the more we do, the worse that it gets. Sometimes we reach the point in our walk of faith that we've done all that we can do. And brethren, it's time for us to tread water. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. Sometimes we also need to stand still to observe others. You know, at one point, Christ told his disciples to become as little children. So it is in our walk of faith. For it seems that children at times have the type of faith that it does take to move mountains. Tess was a very caring 8-year-old. And she heard her mom and dad talking about her little brother, Andrew. All that she knew, that he was very sick and they were completely out of money. And they were moving out of their home into an apartment complex next month because Daddy didn't have the money for the doctor bills and also the house. Only a costly surgery could save her brother now. And it was looking like there was no one to loan them the money. And she heard her daddy tell her mother with whispered desperation, only a miracle can save him now. Tess went to her bedroom and pulled out a glass jelly jar from its hiding place in the closet. And she poured all the change out on the floor and carefully counted it 3 times. The total had to be exactly perfect. No chance for mistakes here. And carefully placing the coins in the jar and twisting on the top, she went out the back door, made her way 6 blocks to the drugstore. And she waited patiently for the pharmacist to give her some attention. But he was intently talking to another man. He was too intent to be bothered by this 8-year-old. So Tess twisted her feet to make a scuffling noise, nothing. She cleared her throat in the most disgusting way she could. Did no good. Finally, she took a quarter from her jar and started tapping it on the glass counter. What do you want? The pharmacist asked. I'm talking to my brother from Chicago, whom I haven't seen in ages. Well, I want to talk to you about my brother. He's really sick, and I want to buy a miracle. I beg your pardon? His name is Andrew, and he has something bad growing in his head. And my dad said only a miracle can save him now. How much does a miracle cost? We don't sell miracles here, little girl. I'm sorry, but I can't help you. She replied, listen, I've got the money to pay for it. If it isn't enough, I'll get the rest. Just tell me how much it cost. And the pharmacist's brother was a was a well-dressed man. He stooped down and asked the little girl, "What kind of miracle does your brother need?" "I don't know," Tess said. "I know he's really sick, and Mommy said he needs an operation. But my daddy can't pay for it, so I want to use my money." How much money do you have?" asked the man. $1.11. "It's all the money I have, but maybe I can get some more if I need to." "What a coincidence," the man smiled. $1.11 is the exact price of a miracle for a little brother." He took the money in one hand. With the other hand, he grasped her mitten and said, "Take me to where you live. I want to see your brother and meet your parents. Let's see if I have the kind of miracle that your brother needs." And this well-dressed man was Dr. Carlton Armstrong, a surgeon specializing in neurosurgery. And the operation was completed without charge, and it wasn't long till little Andrew went home again, and he's doing well. Mom and Dad were happily talking about the chain of events that had taken place. "That surgery," her mom whispered, "was a real miracle. I wonder how much it would have cost." Tess smiled. She knew exactly how much a miracle cost. $1.11 plus the faith of a little child. You know, living faith doesn't end with childhood. Revelation 2, we find it is a continuing process. We must continue to grow in faith. We must remain faithful until death. Revelation 2:10. In Revelation chapter 2, verse 10, "Do not fear any of these things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. And you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life." One of the most heroic stories to come out of the Korean War involved a young sergeant by the name of James Hatfield. He had been engaged in severe fighting on Heartbreak Hill. And when the shooting had subsided, a rescue team was dispatched out on the battlefield to go out and aid the wounded. And the sergeant was out there. He was found dying, but they discovered something very unusual. Although his hands were paralyzed, he was holding between his teeth the two ends of a communication cable that had been broken. You know, in that moment, when one would expect every thought and concern to be directed toward his own needs, his own dying needs, he was still doing what he could to keep the messages going through. Brethren, he was faithful to his calls unto death. You know, many Christians may be put to shame by his noble example. You know, sad to say, when the going gets rough, the demand's too great, the sacrifice too costly, or the shame of the stake too much to bear, they desert their post and flee back to the lines where it's more comfortable and secure. Some even have gone AWOL. Brethren, today we've seen that when Christ returns a second time, that faith will be a very rare commodity. But we as Christians must have living faith. We must have this faith. Without faith, we cannot please God. So like John the Baptist and Peter, we have to learn to believe God, develop this faith in God. We must know God, and we can know God through Bible study and prayer. And because we express this faith, God promises to prosper us, heal us, protect us, and yes, even at times, bring trials upon us for our own good. The fields were parched and brown from lack of rain, and the crops lay dying from thirst. And the people were anxious and irritable as they searched the sky for a sign of rain, for a sign of relief. And days turned into arid weeks. No rain came. And the ministers of the local churches called for an hour prayer on the town square the following Saturday. And they requested everyone bring an object of faith there for inspiration. And at high noon on the appointed Saturday, the townspeople came out en masse. And they filled the square with anxious faces and hopeful hearts. And the ministers were touched to see the variety of objects clutched, holy books, crosses, rosaries. And when the hour of prayer ended, as if on some magical command, a soft rain began to fall. And cheers swept through the crowd as they held these objects up in gratitude and praise. But from the middle of the crowd, one faith symbol seemed to overshadow all the others. It was a small 9-year-old child. She had brought an umbrella. So, brethren, as we approach the end of this age, and as we see the spiritual drought come upon this land, and as we study, and as we pray, and as we get closer to God, as we grow in faith, and as we're waiting and praying for that spiritual rain to begin to fall, let's make sure that we're like that little 9-year-old child. And at the return of Christ, we are standing there with our spiritual umbrella so that Christ can answer the question, yes, I found faith on the earth when I returned.